You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 98.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
You have reached another Local Maximum. As we close out the year, as we close out 2019, the responses to the last few episodes have been tremendous. I know I've been told I can't use tremendous anymore because the president uses it, but that's okay. Ugh, he uses that phrase too. He uses that's okay. But by the way, I saw the latest Star Wars last night. Is this something that you want me to discuss on the show, localmaxradio@gmail.com, to answer that question? No spoilers, of course. I'm still open-ended on how I rate it, but I have to think about whether it'll be memorable or not, you know, in the years to come. But it was a lot of fun. That was episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. So been up pretty late with that, with holiday parties, all that good stuff. Anyway, look, we've had record numbers of listeners to these episodes, and I think next week in episode 99, I'll share some of the your comments on the climate protesters, on Pascal's Wager, and also on the computer science topics we discussed. Today's topic, I think, brings it together a little bit, which is great, because we're going to be talking about Bayesian inference again, but also about elections, about forecasting, and social choice theory, strategic voting in elections. And we start to get into all these electoral systems around the world, the mistakes that journalists and pollsters make around the world. And so if whether you're a coder or you like the kind of the news political junkie angle, I think this episode is going to make you happy. Today's episode is sponsored by Manning Publishing. Go to manning.com and use discount code PODLOCALMAX19. To get 40% off all their books, which are of particular interest to the software engineers and data scientists in the audience. So without further delay, today's guest called me remotely all the way from France. He is the host of the new podcast, Learning Bayesian Statistics, and he runs the political forecasting site PollsPosition.com, where he uses Bayesian inference and logical thinking in general to analyze political trends and make predictions all over the world. Alex Andara, welcome to the show. You have reached the local maximum.
Thank you, Max. I'm really glad to be in your show. I'm one of your listeners every week, so it's an honor to be here.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to hear that. It's very rare that I get to have a listener on the show. Well, actually, I don't know. I think I've had a few listeners in the past, but I'd have to go count that. But no, thank you so much for listening to the show. It really does mean a lot to me. And you know this too, like when you start your podcast and you started Learning Bayesian Statistics, I'm really glad you started it. Isn't it so cool when you see people who like actually are interested in the same things that you're interested in?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, and yeah. I mean, congrats on your podcast. I listen to it because it's great.
Well, thanks. Can you tell us a little bit about what you plan to cover on Learning Bayesian Statistics podcast? You're what, four or five episodes in?
Yeah, exactly. I just released the fourth episode this past week. I'm really excited about this one. I had a lot of fun recording it. It's with a researcher called Karin Knudsen. And we're talking about Dirichlet processes and how she uses them to study neurodegenerative diseases at Mass General Hospital in Boston. So it's really cool because she explains Dirichlet processes on the show, and it's a hard topic. So and she does
oh my god through
job.
Audio. Now,
yeah,
I know,
exactly.
You might not know this. I actually have a video on, or several videos and a paper on the Dirichlet distribution.
Oh, yeah.
Online. And so this is, I know personally firsthand how cool it is once you wrap your head around it, what's really going on.
Yeah.
The whole conjugate prior thing is awesome. Yeah, yeah. But it's describing it in audio, trying to bring it to life through words is an exciting challenge. I'm glad you guys are taking it on. So tell me a little bit about, what you've done with the podcast so far, where you plan to go with it, and why you started it.
Yeah. Well, as you said, my show is called learning Bayesian statistics. It's not a very original name, but at least it's descriptive.
But people will find it.
Exactly. So as the name says, it's a podcast dedicated to Bayesian inference. The idea is to give people an endpoint to stay up to date or simply to understand what Bayesian inference is. And actually, I had the idea because when I started learning Bayesian methods about 3 years ago, I really wished there were podcasts out there that could introduce me to the methods and the projects and the people who make all that possible. And I mean, there were amazing online resources and books, and I work a lot with Python and a package called PyMC3, which is awesome. And the community here is really incredibly welcoming, and the core devs of PyMC in particular. But I don't know about you, but I'm a voracious podcast listener. I love audio content, and what I love about them is that I find that more efficient than several days of Google search, you know.
Sure.
Often I'm like, oh, wait. Oh, yeah, I remember on this show, in this episode, that guy talked about that project that could be useful in my case right now. So I go to the website, yeah.
Yeah, in podcasting, it's like you get one person's perspective and they take you through step by step.
Yeah.
It's more like that's the benefit of reading a book too, where it's like, you know, you have a single perspective and they kind of build you up from the foundations. Whereas Google searches, you have people coming in all over the place. You know, you have blog posts that are hastily put together. Some information is good, some information is bad, you know, and you just don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why I wanted, you know, stuff like a show like that where people could do the same thing that I do on other podcasts. They go to the show notes and then they click on the link of the guest or of her project, and bam, they have the information they wanted. Plus, it gives you, as you said, sometimes you listen to an episode about a topic you didn't know anything about, and it opens some perspective for you. So, yeah, it's basically the idea of the podcast. And so I interview researchers and practitioners of all fields. I'm really I'm kind of curious, so I like to discover new topics. So I interview people of all fields about why and how they use Bayesian statistics, how they came to the methods, and what their projects and especially what their challenges are. Because you do a statistical modeling yourself, you know that it can sometimes feel very lonely. So I wanted to...
Especially if, you know, a lot of people out there, probably the only ones at their company who do it or part of a very small team. And also, like, you know, when you build up this kind of expertise on these statistical methods, you know, a lot of times, well, I could say, well, yes, I do this on location data and on marketing data, and that's great. But I feel like maybe by learning your show, I can learn about how these methods can be applied to all sorts of different areas in science and technology and research that I wouldn't even know about otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Typically, it's really whether you want to learn Bayesian statistics or hear about the latest libraries, books, and awesome application. I thought this podcast exactly for that. And yeah, the as you said, typically the fourth episode with Karin Knudsen, I really didn't know anything about neurodegenerative diseases.
I don't either.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting, and she does an amazing work. And as far as what topics I want to cover on the podcast in the coming weeks, I have some exciting episodes on the deck. I have one for in 2 weeks. It will be how to use Bayes in biomedicine with Eric Ma, who is a core dev of PyMC and also does data science at Novartis. So it's really interesting to hear from his perspective, because Novartis is also a large organization. So it's also the question of well, how do you get your coworkers more used to posterior distributions than p-values schematically? You know, so it's
spreading the good word, spreading the gospel. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, also it's kind of diverse. I had the chance to interview the other day Michael Bittencourt, who is one of the Stan core developer this time. Stan is a kind of the seminal probabilistic programming language. And he talked about principled Bayesian workflow. It's his thing right now. And it's really the idea that sometimes you feel lost when you build a model and you ask yourself why what you're trying to do is so damn hard. and often you conclude that you are the problem and that you must be something doing something wrong.
Yeah, that's a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
We all feel so, that way sometimes.
Yeah. And Michael is really someone very
take a step back, take a few breaths.
Back. Plus, he's really bright, and you'll hear it on the podcast saying that, well, yeah, it's hard for me too. It's the point, and it's that it's hard for everybody. So just come down and remember that if you don't fail, you don't learn. So I find this episode very inspiring. I hope the listeners will too.
Well, yeah, no, I think that I would get a lot of value out of that discussion and the other ones you mentioned. So I'm definitely going to subscribe to learning Bayesian statistics, and maybe I'll make it a part of my routine.
I
wanted to ask you, Bayesian inference is used by many technical researchers and forecasters, but what would you like the average person to know about Bayesian inference?
Yeah, that's a hard one. One of the nice things about Bayesian inference is I think it's easier to explain than to practice. When you practice...
Except when someone already has it in their mind that statistics means this and that this is going to be very complicated, then it can get more difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. But as you said, the average person, I guess that they don't know that much about specific statistics. I mean, even like p-values, I really don't think it's really well known by the average person in France. I don't know in the US, but I guess it's the same thing.
Yeah. And, so how would you like explain it to them? Like what you're trying to do, the kind of the essence of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually I just stick to like the philosophical definition, I'd say, and how it is very close to how our brain makes sense of the world, like intuitively. I mean, generally, when you think about some subject, you have some prior knowledge about it. You can call that the state of the world if you want. And then you have new data that arrive, and then you process that data, and well, then you update your knowledge about the state of the world. And often the question is, how do you process these new data? How do you incorporate them in how you make sense of the world? That's actually quite tricky because we do that instinctively, but that's the step where a lot of cognitive biases take place, you know?
Right. We do it instinctively, but we don't always do it well.
Exactly. And that's where all these biases come into play. And what I often say is that, well, if you're serious about getting to the truth, I mean, not being right, but really knowing whether something you're believing is true or not, then Bayesian inference and Bayes' rule is the most logical way to update your belief. I don't mean that it will give you the right answer. I'm not saying that. I mean that it's the most logical way to update what you believed before you saw the new data that you just saw.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to get into your work on election forecasting. I don't have this written here, but I actually kind of want to know how you got into election and political forecasting. I cover elections and politics sometimes here in the Local Maximum.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you we're going to cover it a lot more over the next year.
Yeah,
given
I bet.
That it's the election year, presidential election year in the U.S. So how did you get into it? And what aspects of the electoral process and polling are you do you focus in?
Yeah. Well, I remember very well how I got into it. I was writing a book, actually, about the US in summer 2016. So it was, of course, already the presidential election in the US.
Right.
So I was following that very closely. And I came across this small website. I don't know if you know it. That's called 538.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's not very small right now.
Yeah. I was thinking that's what you're going to say. I'm like, nah, he said small. He's going to say something else.
Yeah, exactly.
I still might know it because I know some of the small ones.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I came across 538A. I was like blown away by that stuff. I was like, man, that's really awesome, because what I always like about Beijing Inference is that it forces you to update your belief even in a direction that you don't like, if the data imply it, So it's a really good way to check the hooligan who is hidden inside all of us, And this hooligan is really present, especially when you're talking about politics. So I was like, wow, that's really cool. We should have that in Europe. And so I was like, yeah, let's try to do that. And I did that with two of my friends. We basically tried to do a project very inspired by 538 in France. That's called Pulse Position. And that's not always very easy, because people tend to, focus on the last poll, and they just they don't check if you often hear, oh, there is this new poll and I don't know, Le Pen is like the election's new favorite, but
right.
Then people would just forget about that, and they don't check if the next poll denied the status of the new favorite candidate,
And yeah, we'd always hear like, oh, a new poll says, so-and-so is ahead. And then you realize there are like 10 polls taken that day, and that one was kind of the wild one.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
exactly.
Reporters, journalists kind of pick and choose what they focus on.
Yeah, yeah. And
I like to think they're focusing on which one has the best methodology and data set. But I don't think that's actually going on.
No. At least that's not what I witnessed in France. And yeah, so the whole project was to help people be less emotional about that, and more robust to partisan manipulation, more skeptical of people cherry picking polls and saying, oh, yeah, that's right, this candidate is in the lead. And again, it's about getting to the truth instead of being right, because you feel right when the candidate you root for is elected. But it's not always the truth that your candidate was in the lead during the whole campaign. So the idea was, to check narratives, to see where the nuances were. Also to check name recognition, because as you said, usually people think that the most famous or the oldest pollster is the best. And it's actually
Of the pollsters, not the candidates.
Not the candidates. No.
Well,
of the pollsters.
Name recognition of the candidate also matters a lot. Early on.
Totally. But now here I'm talking about how the polls are communicated to the people, and usually you have this heuristic that's really useful for snap decisions, but for complicated, multidimensional, evolving systems like elections, just relying on a simple name recognition heuristics for polls is really not what you should do. So the big question of Pulse Position is, well, let's check the narrative and let's see what's the real state of the races and what really seems to influence voters' decisions.
All right, so I just want everyone to know that this episode is sponsored by Manning Publishing. Go to manning.com and get all of their books, among them Deep Learning with Structured Data by Mark Ryan, who I interviewed on episode 87. Deep Learning with Structured Data will teach you how to apply powerful deep learning analysis techniques to structured data found in the relational databases that real-world businesses depend on. Also, last week, and I got a lot of great responses from last week's interview, that was with David Kopeck in episode 97, localmaxradio.com/97, and that was on classic computer science problems in Python and also in Swift. A lot of people asking me for all those free ebooks we were giving out. But remember, if you missed that, PodLocalMax19 is the discount code at manning.com. And you can go there and get 40% off all Manning books, including Deep Learning with Structured Data and including classic computer science problems in Python and classic computer science problems in Swift. And I look through these, a lot of great discussions. Also check out the last two episodes, those two episodes, 87 and 97, because we really got into this topic to see if you'd be interested. We have a lot of Manning books in our Foursquare library at work, and it would make a great addition to your work library. Learn computer science, learn technical frameworks, make your job skills more marketable by go to manning.com and applying the code PodLocalMax19 to get that discount. All right, now back to the show. Yeah, so you started writing about elections in 2016. You said you got into Bayesian inference about 3 years ago, so that kind of lines up. Yeah. That was primarily what brought you into Bayesian inference, trying to look at that problem?
Yeah, completely.
I feel like one of the, like, it's easy to judge someone, oh, they just want, you know, this outcome, and therefore they're forming that beliefs. But actually, it doesn't come naturally to us at all to just kind of say, okay, I'm just going to bring in the data, let my numbers crunch, and then let that be it. You really have to make kind of an effort to do it. Hmm. And in fact, you know, like, you actually have to make an effort to set up, you know, your set up Bayesian inference, like what am I trying to learn, and am I going to believe it beforehand? I think just when all of us kind of, when left to our own devices, our beliefs kind of, it's weird, right? Because our brains, as you said, use Bayesian inference, but then, you know, we diverge from it a lot. We take shortcuts and we diverge from it. And the shortcuts help us sometimes in some areas, but hurt us in others.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that was a bit of a rant, but.
No, that's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's very jarring for people when pollsters get election results very wrong, or in some cases, you know, they don't necessarily get it wrong. They're just perceived to have gotten it wrong when they actually did kind of a reasonable job at coming up with the probabilities. But when you look at how polls are conducted and analyzed and explained to the public, what do you find is really going on?
Yeah. So to answer your question quickly, and then I'll detail that. But I think the problem, at least in France, is more in the analysis and in how polls are explained to the public and not really in how they are conducted. I mean, of course, you always have room for improvement, and French pollsters are not perfect. But actually, we did an analysis of pollsters' historical performance on the website, and that's actually one of our weights in our polling average. And, well, French pollsters are actually pretty good. I mean, they have a 2-point average error for surveys of, like, 1,000 people and 40 million people electorate. So that's really not bad, especially compared to, for instance, UK pollsters. So I think the feeling that polls are less and less reliable come mostly from communication. And One of the things I think is that in France, political journalism is still not very data driven. I mean, most journalists come from arts curricula, and the coverage is mainly through op-eds and big theories. So I'm not saying it's not interesting. It's actually intellectually stimulating, because most of these journalists are very educated, very smart, and very knowledgeable. But when you do this kind of theoretical reasoning and don't confront it to data, well, often you end up using logical arguments rather than factual ones, you know, and ultimately...
Well, logical doesn't sound that bad.
yeah, but it can be logical and wrong, you know, not factually true.
Right.
You know, it can, if you just...
Narrative-based.
Yeah.
It could be like narrative-based arguments.
Exactly. And so ultimately it gives way to cherry picking, as we said. And yeah, you just pick the poll that suits more the narrative you already believed in. That's one of the problem. And what I'm trying to say is, let's come down and look at the big picture and what can we say given our data and model, given all the data and not the one that suits our narrative. And especially one of my big points always is, where are the uncertainties? You know, what would be surprising? What are the odds of each scenario? So, yeah, that's...
Can you give an example where, like, you know, there'd be one area where you're not as concerned about uncertainty and another area where you are?
Do you mean in elections?
Sure. Yeah. Like, can you just give me an example of where maybe an uncertainty that you've come across that either you've been worried about or maybe that it came to fruition that they haven't been discussing?
Yeah. So, for instance, thanks to the pollster ratings that we did, we noticed that during the five last elections, French pollsters tended...
These would be the French presidential elections?
All elections. I mean...
all elections, yeah, okay.
Like at all levels, regional, presidential, parliament, and so on. And during,
gotcha, cool.
During
you have to explain to us a little bit about the... I know a little bit about the electoral system there, but you might have to fill us in on some of the details.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And please ask me when something is not clear. But we looked at all the types of election. And I think during the five last elections, pollsters tended to overestimate the far-right party. While
against how they did ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. Compared to the result, they tended to overestimate the far-right party. Hmm. And what's interesting is that the conventional wisdom, I mean, at every election was that, the big uncertainty is that pollsters are gonna underestimate the far right party, you know. So it was like really in most of the media was like, we have to be careful about the fact that maybe the far right will be underestimated. And actually, that's one of the examples where conventional wisdom, when it takes into account uncertainties, it takes into account uncertainties that goes into their already made narrative, you know. I mean,
right? Because so let me just take a stab at trying to explain. Like, had that vote total for the far right parties been underestimated in the past? Or was that just an idea that was out there that was going to be underestimated?
Yeah, exactly. That was just an idea. I mean, there was one election, one big election in 2002, on the first round, where the far-right party was underestimated by pollsters. And it turned out that because of that, pollsters didn't see that the far-right party would be present at the second round, which was like, huge at the time.
Yeah, I remember that election.
Yeah, it was like huge. It was a seismic change in French politics. It was the first time in history that the far right was present at the second round. And so, you know, these elections like really shook things up, I think, in the media and the political narrative. But what I did was like, well, I always hear that pollsters tend to underestimate the far right. Is that true or not? And I looked at the data, and it it's actually not true for the five last elections. They tended to overestimate the far right. And what I mean by that is that, contrary to the model, when you're just looking at the numbers on your own, you tend to forget that uncertainties are most of the time symmetrical. So, yeah, of course, the far right could be underestimated, but they also could be overestimated. And actually, if you look in recent history, they tend to overestimate the far right. So maybe if you think with the Bayesian perspective, you should put a higher prior on the fact that the far right will be overestimated than underestimated.
Right. Yeah. And the model could probably account for either possibility.
Exactly. And that's exactly what the model did for the election last year. There were this year in May, there were elections at the European level. But,
sure.
But these elections take place in all European countries independently, and then votes are counted and aggregated at the European scale. And actually, yeah, the model saw that there were a big possibility that the far right party could be overestimated, and it was overestimated again. So that's typically the kind of situation where having a principled way to look at the data and to make sense of new data arriving, to incorporate all these new data in what you should think about the state of the race, that's a perfect example of why it's difficult to do that just by hand.
Yeah. We live, we're in interesting times now in kind of world. If you look at like all of the elections going on around the world, maybe this is just my impression, but I feel this way, is that while you had stable party politics before, now across Europe, you just see a lot of these smaller parties making a lot of headway on both sides of the political aisle. That it seems like things that there are, I'm not really sure, but there are a lot of uncertainties that need to be accounted for. I don't know if there's a way to kind of predict, you know, how well, how you know, what kind of room to move different parties have. I mean, I remember when you know, Donald Trump was running and he was at, I don't know, he was at a certain point in the primary, like maybe he was at 20%. And, you know, I think it was Karl Rove, who was George Bush's head of George Bush's pollster, you know, his campaign manager. He said, well, sure, he has 20% of the people who really like him, but the other 80% will never vote for him or something like that. That turned out to be wrong. And so the question is like, I don't know if there's a good way of like trying to figure out how dynamic the electorate is right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of
I mean, I feel like we're just going to learn a lot over the next 10 years about how to solve these problems.
Yeah, exactly. That's both very difficult and very interesting. I mean, right now in France, for instance, you've got like the two traditional parties.
They weren't even in the presidential election in the second round, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That would be like, imagine if in the US, if like the two candidates running were the Democrats were not really in it and the Republicans were not really in it. It was basically just two third party candidates running against each other. That would just be insane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in France right now, it's kind of like that. And you've got the two traditional parties that kind of disappeared for the moment. And so you have two big parties, which are Macron's parties, which is basically at the center-right of the spectrum. And then you've got Le Pen's party, which is on the far right. These are the two main parties right now, and you also have a recomposition on the left of the spectrum, which is undergoing a lot of changes. So it's really kind of messy right now. And for instance, I'm working right now on a model to try to predict the results of Paris City Council elections next year. And
okay.
I'm trying
to year out. That's
Yeah, that's really hard in part because, well, first I'm trying to do that at the district level. So Paris is divided into 20 districts, which are called arrondissements. And so I'm trying to predict the election at that level. And also one of the big things is that 6 years ago, which were the last city council election in Paris, there were no centrist party. So, but this year, there will be a centrist party, and it is Macron's party. So it's a big party. So
yeah,
it means like when your model is looking at historical patterns, it's really difficult to tell him that, you know, well, yeah, last time there were no parties at the center of the spectrum, but no, there is one. And oh, by the way, it's the party of the president, so you can't really ignore it. It's not something you can just brush off, you know. So yeah, I'm working on that right now, and it's very difficult, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about you know, how you model these elections and electoral prospects? What methods have you had success with? And can you tell us a little bit about the hierarchical modeling?
Oh yeah, my pleasure. So yeah, as you said earlier,
I love hierarchical models, but I don't, it's going to be tough with the audio format, but we'll do our best.
Yeah, exactly. It's the challenge accepted. Yeah, as you said earlier, I think Bayesian inference is a really natural framework here for election because uncertainty estimation is one of its core pillars. And as I said, I think it's one of the cases where you really care about uncertainty. So yeah.
I also think, if I can add another reason, yeah, you also get data from a lot of different sources, a lot of different types of data that you have to include in a model.
Mm, yeah.
And like a Bayesian method is better when you want to think about, okay, I have data, this kind of data, maybe this kind of data is a poll, and this other kind of data, which is maybe a poll on maybe like the like economic data or something, how yeah, the economy is doing.
Yeah.
And like, how do I combine these? So Bayesian framework is a lot better to figure out ways to combine them than the, you know, traditional frequentist methods.
Yeah, yeah. It's a framework where you can incorporate measurement error, for instance. So it's really quite easily, actually. I mean, it's amazing how easy conceptually and in coding, how easy that is to incorporate measurement error. Actually, the main problem is how do you fit your model then? But conceptually, it's very easy to incorporate it. And as you said, measurement error is really important when you have polling data mixed with other data. So basically what I did for the European elections is that I had a polling average where I had several weights. The main weights were the date on, well, I just, whenever a new poll arrived, the program would say, well, when was the poll conducted? The more recent, the better. How many people were interviewed? The more people, the better. And where does the poll come from? I mean, which pollsters conducted the poll? It's basically what you do when you read an article, you know, you look at the source. So the program would do the same thing. He would look at the source. Was that poll done by Ipsos or another pollster? And then he would match the poll with the corresponding pollster ratings that we had in our database, which is a historical database of pollsters' performance. And then he would average all of the polls and give that to the model, which is, as you said, a hierarchical model or multi-level model. It's the same thing.
Right. It's like, so you might be looking at the uncertainty of any one given poll, but then also a level up looking at, see if there are any uncertainties like overall.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically that's it. I was
like across the board.
Yeah. I was telling the model, my goal was to tell the model, well, you're going to observe polls and then I want you to try and estimate the latent support in the population for each party. But be careful, because polls are not a perfect observations. They are noisy observation. So you have actually what we call a hidden state. You know, you have a latent proportion, latent support of the population that support each party, but you never observe it really neatly. Even elections are not that clean observation, sure. You know, because you have some people that don't vote, etc. And so I was telling the model, don't forget to take into account these historical errors, you know, of the polls. So yeah, that's why you use several layers of in your model. And actually, if you want, I'm just going to try to sum up the idea and why hierarchical models are amazing.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So basically, they pull information across clusters. Your cluster can be an individual or some date in time or some district. So for instance, for Paris City Council election, I would say that each district is a cluster. So the hierarchical model is going to pull information across all clusters, and that is going to inform the parameters in each cluster. So basically what
right, it's a balancing act between what can we learn about the clusters as a whole, what can we generalize, and what peculiarities are specific to an individual cluster that we shouldn't generalize. And if you just think about it, like when you're just learning something, you know, that's kind of hard to figure out which one to, like, let's say I get a crazy poll in one district. Do I say the poll is wrong? Do I say, okay, that district must be going in a wild direction? Or do I say, hey, maybe everyone is going in that wild direction? And it's not obvious what to say just from one piece of data, but I think that hierarchical model does a very good job of balancing all of those possibilities.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all the more difficult in France, for instance, because you have several parties competing. It's not like in the US where you just have two parties. In France, you usually have at least six parties competing with each other. And so you have basically a huge matrix of a six-dimensional matrix. So it's you can do that by hand. And so yeah, the idea of the multi-level model is that you try to balance underfitting and overfitting at the same time. So, and it achieves that because the estimates are of each district are shrunk towards the mean of the population. So for instance, the mean for all the city, for the whole city, for Paris, and in return, the mean of the population itself is influenced by clusters that have a big sample size, you know? So districts that have a bigger population will have more weight in the population overall, and then they will inform the parameters in other districts.
Yeah. Okay. So one aspect that I know you've spoken about of the electoral system, of different electoral systems, is the idea of strategic voting. I covered some of this previously on the show in episode 48 with Daniel Kronovet. We talked about social choice theory. Episode 72, we talked a little bit about Shapley values, which is, if you're interested, I would direct listeners to episode 72 to talk about that. But that's a measure of how much power an individual voter has in any given system. In fact, you know, there's debate within the U.S. on whether we should change our electoral system in variety of ways. And so what have you learned about how the different rules of the game affect the strategies of the candidates and the voters, or even like how many parties compete?
Yeah. Yeah, first, I like your question because I think my answer will be more digest than the hierarchical model answer for your listeners. So it's good to balance all that.
Of course. Yeah.
But yeah, that's an interesting question. I'll caveat with the fact that I'm not an expert on that subject, but I'm interested in it, of course, because when you study election, you also study the strategies and the game, the rules of the game.
Well, I'd imagine like in the US, like we have districts where it's whoever gets the most votes wins.
Yeah.
And so you have to, it's tough to not have, there are cases where there are multiple parties that compete, mm-hmm. but in most cases, there are two parties that compete and essentially they'll kind of move with relation to each other. But, you know, if one of those are going to win, then there's very little incentive to vote for a third party.
Yeah. 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 In France, it's actually quite different because, well, first in France and in the US, from the academic research I read, different rules do affect strategies of voters and candidates, you know. So if you change the rules, it will change the way voters and candidates will behave. But what you can see in France, for instance, well, first, the most common voting system in France is a two-round election. So
yeah.
Everybody competes in the first round and only the two major candidates go on to the second round. And each time it's the majority that decide. I think it's more and more clear in the literature that in this context, the majority rule is... can actually not be optimal. You know, it can be a suboptimal way to aggregate preferences, mostly because voters tend to vote for their candidate of choice instead of the one who has the most chance at winning.
In the first round,
yeah. So in other words, you know, they vote, I would say, sentimentally and not strategically. And then the problem, and you can all argue that it's actually a good thing, you know, in a democracy, you want people to really express their preferences, their absolute preferences instead of their relative preferences. And so actually the problem here seems to arise from these two round or one round even election, like in France or in the UK. And these elections are very sensitive to what researchers call, in a very non-sexy way, non-relevant alternatives. It's basically
non-relevant alternatives.
Yeah, basically it means that candidates that don't have a shot at winning, but are close ideologically to one who does. Candidates that don't have a shot at winning, but are close ideologically to a candidate who does have a chance, well, these candidates, they actually can provoke the defeat of the candidate preferred by the majority because they cause a dispersion of the votes. You see?
Yeah.
So basically, for instance, in France, imagine you have a left, right, and a Green Party candidate. Green Party candidates tend to be very close to the left party in France. If the Green Party candidate stays in the second round, and it can happen, I'm not going to go in the details, but you can have three candidates like that in the second round.
So it's a little bit more complicated than...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But if the Green candidate stays, and the left candidate, for instance, if the choice of the majority, if this candidate would win without the Green candidate, well... with the Green candidate, it will disperse votes that would have gone to the left candidate otherwise, and then cause the candidate of the right to win, whereas this candidate from the right is not the preferred candidate of the whole majority. You see the paradox?
Yeah. Sure.
So I'm not inventing that. It's the Marquis de Condorcet, like in, I think it's 18th century, that... formalized mathematically these paradox. And
right, Condorcet paradox.
Condorcet paradox, exactly. basically that the majority candidate can lose the election because her voters are divided, leading to the victory of a candidate who only has a relative majority. So yeah. It means that in the runoff system, adding a candidate can change the result of the election. So it opens the door to what you should have heard from now. It's the dilemma of the useful voting, you know, or stuff like that. It means that people can't really express their absolute preferences, and they have to express their relative preferences.
This reminds me of one story that's going on in the U.S. right now, which is, I think there's a lot more going on than just the voting paradox, but Michael Bloomberg, who was the mayor here in New York and, you know, a billionaire, like tens of billions, he got into the race for the Democratic primary. And a lot of people say, well, it's very unlikely that he'll get a majority on that, but he'll spend a lot of money. And so there's this speculation that he's trying to make the, he's trying to get the results to go a particular way. It could just be rather than strategic voting, like trying to get his issues out there or whatever. There's a lot of speculation on how this will affect the other candidates. And I've seen articles go both ways. I've seen, well, maybe this will help Joe Biden because he has the most name recognition and the other candidates have less name recognition. And now with Bloomberg in there, it's going to be hard for them to bubble up. Or maybe because, you know, Bloomberg's going to be a little bit more pro-business, then he'll sort of split the vote with Biden and it will help those candidates. Mm-hmm. Whether that happens or what actually happens remains to be seen.
I think in the US it's a little more complicated than in Europe because you have the electoral college and the winner take all rule.
So that has some very interesting results, and I do want to have, you know, more people on the show to talk about the electoral college. The way it works now is not really what our founders intended, although there are some really interesting outcomes of that are not necessarily negative. I know that a lot of people, there are a lot of people who say, oh yeah, let's definitely get rid of it. But I think if you just get rid of it in favor of whoever gets the most votes, and that won't be someone who gets a majority, wins, then you can have a lot more Condorcet paradox.
Exactly. I would say if you do that, and if you're gonna redo a voting system from scratch, don't go with the one round or two round system. I mean, go with other systems. I mean, there are very interesting alternatives. I think
I would like to see states, within the states, do a lot more. And they are doing some innovation with their electoral system because they can. You know, the Electoral College is in our Constitution, but states can basically do whatever they want. And I don't know if you know this, but California and Louisiana have a system kind of similar to in France, which is two rounds. I think it's called the jungle primary, where everybody runs the first round, and then the second round, it's between two people. Sometimes that has weird results, like in Louisiana in 1991, we had one guy who was openly corrupt, and then he handily defeated another guy who was from the Ku Klux Klan. So it was like, and they did it by basically having a lot of irrelevant candidates run. Split votes.
Yeah, so that's why I'd say if you have to choose a new system, try to choose the system that is the more robust to non-relevant alternatives, because that way you can have candidates that you can have as many candidates as you want. And that's a good thing, you know, like people who want to defend their ideas, well, they can go and run and they won't hurt the election. And also voters, they can express their true preferences, and they can even reject or be indifferent and express that fact, you know. So you have I have two preferred favorite options I'd say that I saw in the literature. That's first the ranked choice voting, and another one that's called the randomized Condorcet voting. The first one is, as the name says, you just rank the candidates, you know, but not with grades.
Yeah.
With words.
We're going to start doing this in New York next year. They only implemented it in a very timid fashion where you could only do it in the primary. So
yeah.
If you're a Democrat, you can pick among the Democratic candidates in your district. And if you're a Republican, you pick among the Republican candidates. And then once those candidates are chosen, election is going to just happen as they are. But it'll be interesting to see people get used to actually doing a ranking list.
Yeah.
And it gives you a lot more, and me is like kind of following along, a lot more interesting things to think about when it comes to the modeling as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's an all other story. But I think I'm really excited about these experimentations that you're doing in the US. And actually, do you know in New York how it's going to be implemented? Are you going to rank the candidates by grade or by, you know, appreciation, like excellent, very good?
No. It's just going to be a ranked list, and it's just going to be for citywide offices and only for the primary. So the final, the final election is just going to be whoever gets, it's just going to be plurality.
Oh, okay. So that means that you're going to rank the different candidates by order of preference.
Yeah, but only to figure out who becomes the Democratic nominee and who becomes the Republican nominee.
Yeah, yeah.
And in New York City, the Democratic nominee always wins. So
yeah,
it's really, that's the election.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. But that's interesting. That's actually the Condorcet voting method that I talked about.
Oh, no, but it's going to be more ranked. It's I would prefer that it be like the Condorcet winner gets
it's,
it.
It's
but
awesome.
It's going to be more like they're just going to count up the first...
the one that's rising first.
They're going to count up people's first place votes, and then the last place, whoever comes in last place is gone off, and then whoever, and then all those voters, they're everything gets shifted up one, so they're second place.
Okay, well, that's interesting, but that's true. It doesn't have all the nice mathematical properties that ranked choice voting and
I said in the last one, they moved from the worst system to the second worst.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah,
we're making progress, but I am interested in see, okay, get voters used to the idea of ranking candidates. Like, is that possible? There are some people who say, oh, you know, nobody wants to go in there and actually rank people. But let's see. We'll actually have some real data and see if that works.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say it's true that a new voting system should be easy to understand. You know, ranked choice voting and randomized Condorcet, it's the good thing that it's really easy to understand. Plus,
Can you give me like a brief, I'm familiar with the idea of a Condorcet winner where like, okay,
yeah,
everyone ranks and then the candidate who would beat every other candidate in a head-to-head wins. But what's a randomized Condorcet?
Oh, randomized is just to, because as you said, the Condorcet voting is head-to-heads. Well, you rank in order of preference and then you do head-to-heads. And the one who wins the most head-to-heads wins. But sometimes you don't have a Condorcet winner. So that's where the randomized part comes in.
Oh, okay.
Because the randomized is basically very complicated math to determine who is the winner when there is no unique Condorcet winner. And to simplify things, it's basically a lottery where the probabilities of each candidate to win the lottery are weighted by each candidate's strength in the head-to-head confrontations.
Okay. I see. I need a whole show to describe that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But
I'll
definitely look into that more.
Yeah. Honestly, that's a very elegant way to solve the Condorcet paradox when there is no winner. And well, but the ranked choice voting is interesting also. And these two methods have the nice property of having no useful voting dilemma for voters. It means you can vote for whoever you want and it won't bias the results.
And that means that then the candidates will change, you know?
Exactly.
Certain people, certain third parties or independents will make a go out of it.
Yeah. You will have more choice. You will have more choice. And you can also express if you reject all the candidates, you can say that. And you can also express your indifference towards the candidates. And also you can see at the end with the results, you can see how comfortable the election was won. You know, so you can see if the winner was had a very good election or if he was elected by a very thin margin. So it gives you this degree of
and nuance. And whether it's actually true that, in your example, like, will the Green Party candidates prefer the left side? Like, is that actually true? We'd know, or to what extent.
Exactly. Yeah, plus, plus you can, it's actually one of the things that you can see in how the electoral college is implemented right now in the US. I mean, you can see how many electoral voters the president got, and it means that the more or less you have means that you were elected more or less comfortably. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's kind of a proxy.
Yeah, it's invertible in that, like, I mean, the electoral college kind of represents, you know, how much geographical. Yeah. You know, whether your support is geographically diverse, which is interesting.
Exactly.
Okay. So I'm going to end on this question. This is a tough question. Might not be a good answer for it. but I want to, you know, as I said before, I feel like we live in a time of great social and technological change. And I always try to, you know, predict trends. And 5 years ago, I was trying to, you know, get into technological forecasting because I wanted to know, you know, what I should be working on, what I should be looking into, what I should be investing in. And I said, okay, I'm not going to try to predict social trends and electoral trends because it's impossible. Now it's 2020, it's 5 years later, and I'm like, okay, we got to at least try because some of these are a really big part of the picture. But, you know, and this is also a huge part of the picture when you're trying to predict elections. Do you think it's possible to predict changes, widespread changes in beliefs and social attitudes? Or do you think I was right originally to just say, no, just use a uniform prior and forget about it?
God, I hope not. But no, it's seriously, of course, here I'm of course biased. But it's actually a question or even a critique I often get. Now, to be clear, I don't think all social attitudes are predictable, but I don't think none are either. You know, I think it depends on the topic. I think I'd say my prior is around 75% of topic that you can predict when it comes to social attitudes. But in general, I think this idea that you can't predict social and political attitudes often rely on one of two assumptions, I'd say. The first one is that statistical forecasting is like horse race punditry. Well, I'd argue that it's kind of the opposite. Because, as I said, what I like in Bayesian forecasting is that you have to display your priors. And then Bayes rule tells you how to update your beliefs, even if you don't like the implication. And so it's clear, it's open, and you can run the model with different priors to see how this changes the analysis. While often in punditry, you'll see that the analysis, it's not very clear how it's done. You don't really know the assumption, the counterfactuals, the uncertainties. And often I think you'll notice that most pundits don't make very precise predictions. You know, it's very broad.
It's based on like what they want to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Plus it tends to be like, you know, broad and evocative, kind of like a fortune teller. So, whereas in statistical forecasting, you have to make precise predictions. And then you check your predictions against the results. So you get feedback and that's how you improve. When you do broad and vague predictions, well, you never fail, but I'd say you never learn. So that's the first thing. And I think the second assumption of the impossibility of social forecasting is, I think, the fact that we as the species, you know, like Homo sapiens, are so unpredictable, that we are so unique and evolved that you can't forecast what we'll do. And it seems a little presumptuous to me because it's not like we're living in a chaotic society. If anything, historically, I think we strive for order to perpetuate the species. You know, we have systemic cognitive biases, and they are called systemic precisely because they are predictable. We use them over and over again when in a given situation. And even on the election side, we vote quite predictably, actually, according to how we were raised, how we were educated, where we live. And these socio-demographic variables, they take a long time to change when they do, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, it's not like the stock exchange. You know, you can foresee the big changes in social demographic trends.
And I think even, you know, you probably can't tell me like, you know, okay, what is going to be the biggest issue in the US in the year 2030? That's too much to ask. But I think, you know, there are certain trends that you can pick up on, particularly if a lot of these pundits are just going based off of, you know, their hopes and dreams and not what's really going on. If you could actually find something in the data, you could actually say something that you could make some real predictions that other people aren't making.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that most of the time our social life and political attitudes are not that chaotic. You know, in fact, it seems that we change our mind quite rarely. And, well, just
because you see individuals online who change their mind, like pundits and stuff, who are all of a sudden different. I mean, maybe they're just following the money. I don't know, but
in the broad numbers, of course, you can find individuals that change their mind. But look at the US right now and how partisan the politics
I've noticed become. It's gotten like steadily worse and worse throughout my life, and I wonder if there is a time when the trend reverses itself, because I don't know.
I mean,
even today we have one, you know, we have a president being impeached with one side saying, you know, this is just ridiculous. They just hate the president. The other side saying, I think someone was quoted saying, this is the most impeachable thing that I've ever seen. Yeah. And it's just like, how could you have such two completely different narrative? I don't know. I guess it could get worse, but
Of course,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, education and
this isn't even an important issue to people now. It's like this is only like the fifth biggest thing that's happened this week in news.
If you look at education and geography, you already can have a good idea of how people will vote in the US. And actually, there is I think I can leave you with that reference. There is a really nice paper from Andrew Gelman and one of his co-author. Of course, I forgot the name of the co-author. I'm sorry, but
all right. Well, we'll link to it. I'll mention it after.
Yeah,
the show.
Yeah, I'll link to it. I'll give you the link. But it's a paper from 2014, and they do a cohort analysis on voters since the 40s, and they actually show, and it's very nice because it's a Bayesian analysis. It's a Bayesian paper.
Yeah. Andrew Gelman.
Yeah. Andrew Gelman is like one of the big stars of the field. And they see that the political events of voters' teenage and early adult years, which is around 18, you know, when you're 18. Well, these events are enormously important in the formation of your long-term partisan preferences.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah, I guess you could say that's very true.
Yeah. So, but it's also kind of depressing, you know, because it means that, well, basically most people won't change their political views.
Although I feel like that's the age people are either forming their political views or maybe maybe they had similar views before, but they were sort of not really interested as much. I'm just, you know, I'm speaking of personal experience and people I know, but I don't know if we could just assume that people aren't if that's like the critical age. But I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have a clear answer on that, except that, yeah, if I reading this paper, I was like, it makes sense that you're the most impressionable. I don't know if impressionable is the word in English, but
yeah. Yeah, no, that's the age to get them at. In other words, people at that age, you convince them.
Yeah, exactly. It's life. Like you're like a sponge, you know, at 18. Yeah. And so you have a lot of, you learn a lot of things and you're really receptive to all the different signals you receive from the outside world. So, and it makes sense that it's at that stage that your most formative views come into being.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But of course, I won't say I'm 100% sure it's true. Yeah. I mean, it's just
just convert everyone to being a good Bayesian and then they'll be open to changing their mind.
Exactly. That's the idea.
All right. Great. Yes, I would support teaching Bayesian inference in high school then.
Oh yeah, me too. But okay. Yeah, keeping in mind, of course, that it's not a magical tool. It's just a tool to help you get to the truth. And sometimes it won't be the best tool to use, but often it's a useful tool and it's good to have that in your toolbox. But just don't be a hooligan Bayesian. It's also hard also to have that in mind. I mean, I love Bayesian statistics, but I also try to not be a hooligan of that and stay open to the critics and the problems that are associated with these methods.
No, I agree. I'm going to cover some of those issues on my podcast, and I'm sure you're going to cover some of those issues on yours. So yeah. I look forward to collaborating in the future. Alex, we're just about out of time. Thanks for coming on the show. Tell people where they could check out the podcast and your other.
So the podcast, people can check it out at learnbayesstats.envol.app. That's ANVIL.APP. And well, you can also
be on the show notes page, localmaxradio.com/98.
Yeah, thanks for that. And of course, yeah, people can reach out to me. I'm quite present on Twitter, and I'm at Alex_Andorra, like the country. And I always like people that reach out to me to give me some feedback and some topic ideas. So please feel free to reach out.
All right. Awesome. Alex, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. It was a great pleasure talking to you. I always love getting into the nerd stuff about politics and Bayes.
All right. Next week is the last episode of the year, the last episode of the decade, episode 99. So I think I'm going to just go over some of your feedback and also kind of take a look back at what I think are the biggest tech stories of the decade. So that'll be a lot of fun. Maybe I'll get Aaron to join me. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.